this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 49, and today I'm joined by Karen Gover and Calliope Nicolopoulou. Karen is an assistant professor of philosophy at Bennington College. She specializes in the areas of hermeneutics, ancient Greek philosophy, and aesthetics. She completed her PhD, I must add, from Penn State. In 2004, with a dissertation titled Heidegger and the Question of Tragedy, which she is expanding into a book on Heidegger and poetry. Portions of this work appear in the International Philosophical Quarterly and in the Journal of the British Society of Phenomenology. And she is also, as I found out by looking you up online, the winner of the American Society for Aesthetics 2011 John Fisher Memorial Prize, awarded biannually for an original essay in aesthetics. So congratulations on that, Karen. And Calliope Nicolopoulou is an assistant professor and director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Comparative Literature at SUNY Buffalo. Her research and teaching interests focus on philosophical approaches to European modernity and psychoanalysis, and the relationship of the ancients to the moderns, with special emphasis on the genre of tragedy and its importance for philosophical thought from German idealism to the present. And she has published articles on literature and continental aesthetics on figures such as Homer, Baudelaire, Henry James, Jean-Luc Nancy, and Adorno and Kant. And she's currently working on two book-length projects. The first is on the relation of the modern lyric to tragedy and catastrophe, and the second on philosophical misreadings of the tragic. Now, Karen and Calliope, join me here in Sundance, Utah, for where we are participating in the 11th Annual Ancient Philosophy Society. So this is another special APS edition of the Digital Dialogue. And we've gathered to talk about the paper that Karen presented on April 14th, entitled Poetic Pessimism, Mortal Fools, and the Transition to Philosophy. And Calliope responded to the essay, and so when I heard this on Thursday, I thought it would be a perfect opportunity for us to extend what I thought was a great paper and a great response and a great conversation. So welcome to the Digital Dialogue.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be a part of it.
Great. So maybe, Karen, if you could talk a little bit about the paper, and then I'll maybe tell you if you can talk about some of the things you pulled out, and we'll start things rolling that way.
Sure. So this paper grew out of some research that I was doing at the Center for Hellenic Studies down in Washington, D.C., and I had gone there originally to think about the meaning of aletheia, since Heidegger had provoked me to do that. And instead, I sort of stumbled on to James Lesher's scholarship on the transition from archaic Greek poetry and myth to philosophy. And James Lesher is also a member of the board of the Center for Hellenic Studies, and I began sort of corresponding with him, as well as reading his work really carefully. And he has, in a series of articles, a sort of theory that he puts forth about the nature of the shift from poetry to philosophy. Mm-hmm. And he has a very compelling and, I think, kind of, if I may say, beautiful idea, which is that we can find there in the early Greek thinkers a sort of shift from what Lesher, and this is his own, I think, rather poetic term, calls poetic pessimism, in which we often find the poets, and I think he doesn't say this, but the tragedians often say this, right, that, you know, mortals know nothing, the gods know everything, and, you know, it's not for us to know the real truth of what's going to happen or what did happen, and et cetera, et cetera. And so he sees there a kind of epistemological pessimism about the possibilities and limits of human knowledge. And then he reads in Xenophanes and Heraclitus and Parmenides a kind of dawning optimism, what he calls philosophic optimism, about the possibilities for humans to acquire knowledge through inquiry.
Right.
And And I was really taken by this this idea, and yet also disturbed by it, because I wasn't sure that it was true.
Right.
It was beautiful, but I wasn't sure that it was true.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're such an excellent scholar, I mean, he's written the commentary on Xenophanes that's just, you know, so comprehensive that, you know, at first I wasn't sure I even wanted to take it on. But it was actually at an Ancient Philosophy Society meeting a couple of years ago, and Rose Cherubin had spoken, who's one of my favorite scholars and expert on Parmenides. And I asked her a question about Lesher's thesis, and she said to me, "Refute Lesher." And I thought, okay, well, if Rose thinks that it's possible, maybe I will at least challenge some aspects of his thesis. So I wrote this paper calling into question Lesher's idea that we find in the early Greek thinkers a kind of dawning of a kind of philosophical optimism. And I was particularly skeptical of the idea that these early Greek thinkers were saying that not just they, but all human beings might be able, through the power of their own kind of critical thinking skills, to sort of achieve knowledge. Because I'm not really sure that that's the case. Nor do I think that the early Greek poets were as pessimistic as Lesher says.
Yeah,
so that was sort of the beginning.
So Calliope, what were the issues that you raised in conjunction to that? Because I thought I thought it was really compelling, the setting up the Lesher's project, and then I think you did a nice job, Karen, of really articulating the problems with it.
Yes, I also want to thank you for including me in the conversation, and to Karen for a very illuminating paper. Yeah. I am very concerned with similar issues and this kind of transition, also the relationship of optimism and pessimism, and how we understand those terms philosophically and how they have developed also in the history of philosophy. So I was very happy to respond. As I pointed in the response, I am largely sympathetic to, particularly to the one aspect that she emphasizes, that Karen emphasizes in the paper, which is to show why philosophy may have a pessimistic, more pessimistic component than what is allowed by Lesher. However, the way that I arrive at that, or the way that I engaged with her paper, was to also try to think about this term slightly differently in relation to optimism in the story. And one of the issues that I brought up, and I would be interested in hearing if Karen has anything to say, is how would a figure like Nietzsche, for instance, fall into this situation next to Lesher? I understand that you are at this level narrowly interested in Lesher's thesis, but how would you understand the question of optimism and pessimism as it gets worked in Nietzsche? Because he, in a certain way, he also makes a similar argument to Lesher, but gives an opening to a different conclusion. For him too, Socrates is an optimist. This is exactly how he killed tragedy in a sense. But but Nietzsche is also aware that Socrates performs in a sense now tragedy. We don't need to go out and see tragedies. We see actually tragedy enacted in the very Socratic project. In fact, that ends up nowhere. It ends up in aporia. It ends up in a sort of negative announcing of I don't know anything, exactly the kinds of issues that you were bringing up. But I think that in Nietzsche, it's interesting that it goes via this discursive optimism first, and then it ends up there, which is why I suggested that maybe the relationship might be not only one of continuity, discontinuity, that there is just a passage from an epoch of optimism, of pessimism from the poets, to an optimism of the philosophers, but rather a kind of a passage within those terms from one to another, both in poetry and in philosophy.
Yeah.
That was one of the issues that I thought. Maybe I stop here and Karen can tell us more.
Sure.
I mean, that's a really interesting suggestion. I admit I didn't have Nietzsche on my mind, but now that you bring out the connection, you know, his reading in The Birth of Tragedy, of seeing Socrates as an optimist, I can well understand how that fits with what Lesher was saying. And it's difficult since Nietzsche himself is sort of a project to contend with. I mean, one of the things that really came out in the discussion of my paper was the sort of the disagreements about whether Socrates is an optimist or a pessimist, right? And everyone seems to think they know who he is, and I have strong feelings about it, but everyone else seems to have equally mm-hmm. strong feelings that disagree with it. So first we might have to, you know, my temptation is to say, well, maybe Nietzsche has a certain agenda of his own in right. making Socrates mm-hmm. be out that way. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I'm just not so sure that... that Socrates is as optimistic as maybe Nietzsche or Lesher also wants to suggest. I mean, the thing is that Lesher doesn't really talk about, I should say, Socrates nearly as much. He's really concerned with the what I call the proto-philosophers. Yeah. I think it's anachronistic to call them the pre-Socratics, so I tried not to. you know, he's really interested in reading Xenophanes and Heraclitus and Parmenides. And but I mean, for me, Socrates is such an interesting example of someone who's always calling attention to the difference and the distance between what, you know, divine wisdom versus his own kind of, you know, human wisdom. And this seemed to me to fit with the what I was interested in is the kind of continuity between that distinction and the very one that Lesher is sort of pointing to in Homer and Hesiod and Simonides and others, right, who seem to be making that exact same distinction. So I wanted to, I think I must say that, you know, in sort of talking about this transition, you tend to get scholars split into either, you know, emphasizing the discontinuity between poetry and philosophy mm-hmm. or the continuity, yeah. right? And so I was sort of trying to push it dialectically back toward emphasizing, you know, looking at the points of continuity. I think ultimately that, I mean, the truth is that there is both continuity and discontinuity. Right, right, right. And that's what's so difficult and so rich.
Well, I mean, I wonder what, and maybe, Calliope, you can tell us a little bit more about the way you're parsing optimism and pessimism in this context also, because you said you had a little bit different approach. But I do wonder, I mean, I think it's pretty clear, as you were arguing, Karen, in the paper, I thought, and also, Calliope, that you, as you said, that, you know, you can't just characterize any thinker as just optimistic or pessimistic. I mean, so then I would begin to wonder, okay, what's the philosophical work this distinction is doing for someone like Lesher, for someone like Nietzsche, if, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, the Apollonian and the Dionysian or whatever the Nietzsche is going to, distinction he's going to make. So I think that's a...
The work I think that it does for Nietzsche, at least the way that I understand it and that it is of interest to me, is in so far as he connects optimism with a certain elision of the tragic worldview. Mm-hmm. And with that elision then comes also what he would call... we lose also what he calls the strong pessimism of the Greeks, mm-hmm. right? That it's not just simply a pessimism as we mean it in a popular usage, but a certain kind of an attitude towards the world that shows also a position of strength in being able to cope with mm-hmm. what is unbearable, in mm-hmm. a sense, right? And philosophy for him or the Socratic project elides in a sense that. But
so what's the? I mean, to what degree is what we're calling pessimism linked to the question of finitude and and our response to a certain kind of finitude? Because one way to parse that it would be to say, the optimist thinks, the philosophical optimist, and actually Drew Hyland does some work with this in some of his work when he looks at the, you know, he thinks Thales is this big optimistic philosopher because he thinks everything is water and water is knowable, right? And so the principles of things are ultimately knowable. This is a kind of optimistic position, mm-hmm. but it's also a denial of a certain kind of finitude, namely there's always a lack, there's always an inability to understand, there's always and so I wonder about the relationship between optimism, pessimism, and finitude and a certain kinds of attitude toward finitude.
Do you want to go first then?
Wow. I mean, it's a hard question, Chris.
Yeah, sorry. But you seem like you have...
Yes, no, I agree. I think that actually Karen put it forth before when she talked about the limits, the limits of knowledge, and that I think that I know one thing that I know nothing is one of the famous articulations of something like that, and I think that this is why I surmise, but I might not be right, that you connect Socrates with a certain pessimism.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, I think, yes. So, I mean, the interesting thing about limits is that when these poets and proto-philosophers talk about the limits, of course, in order to think the limit, in order to sort of, you know, know the limit, you're in a way already knowing more than the limit. You're sort of, you know, to be able to comment on even the sort of distance between the gods and mortals is already to kind of have a sort of outside perspective that is then able to see that distance. And this is why I was sort of emphasizing that, like the poets, the proto-philosophers take a kind of, they then put themselves in a special position, sort of elevated above the common herd, as it were, right? Not claiming to be gods, but still having a special kind of authority, right? That in the case of the poets then comes from the muses, and then maybe with, you know, someone like Xenophanes and others, there might be, you know, they're not calling upon the muses, but nevertheless they are invoking a certain kind of authority, and this happens in various ways, that enables them to speak as what Detienne will call a master of truth, right? That then gives their wisdom a sort of special weight that in which they know more than other people. And, you know, and so then, you know, Heraclitus complains that even when he tells people the truth, they still don't understand it, right? So then you ask, if mortals really just know nothing, then how is it that any of these people, poets or proto-philosophers, would ever be able to say anything?
Right. But I mean, but on those terms, you're couching it out in terms of a certain kind of legitimizing project. So the philosophers are, in a certain sense, recognizing that they're not connected to the gods through the muses. So what I'm saying is not, you know, this just divine revelation. But most of the proto-philosophers are either have the figure of a god or goddess or something in their poems, or appeal to, you know, certain kinds of images of the divine that are really powerful. But then there's a legitimizing effect, because one has to sort of differentiate oneself, I guess, from the hoi polloi.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and in response to that, I thought it was very interesting whether we can at all make any, at least preliminary, distinction between the figure of authority, particularly in relation to pedagogy, and then perhaps authoritarianism. And Karen and I were talking about this later, but also what we mean by democracy, what we mean in an almost narrow sense, the aspect of democracy in pedagogy, in teaching. Yeah. And in relation to Socrates, it always occurred to me, again, that you can make both arguments in good faith, in a sense, that you mentioned the daemonion, and other people mentioned, in fact, the mission, which is from the oracle, which gives him a direct purpose, a divine purpose, in fact, to what he does, but which you could argue also that it is a finite. What is to prove that you are the wisest of all?
Right.
In time, forever, right now, it's a kind of an interesting...
And it depends on his self-interpretation of that.
Precisely.
So, but I mean, this is interesting. We're pushing you to Socrates, and I'm happy to go, and because I mean, it's part of the project I'm working on, but Karen, you're trying to make the point. You know, you actually in the session sort of said, well, in a way, Socrates isn't the issue. It's these proto-philosophers. But
I felt that actually other people were telling me that I should leave Socrates out of it. And you know, I mean, I think in terms of expanding the project, that I want to turn to Socrates. But you know, Catherine Zuckert, in her sort of masterful most recent book about the unity of the dialogues, sort of makes it a very similar point, actually, where she reads Socrates as actually not terribly optimistic at all. Similarly, there's a Vlastos at one point says, of all people, says something that sounds like it would support my thesis that Socrates was not, you know, a man of the people bringing critical thinking down to earth. But really, you know, what I'm interested in is, and I'm drawing upon work of people like Andrea Nightingale, who is sort of looking at this transition also in terms of a kind of contest of wisdom, right, in which there's a sort of, as Calliope appropriately called it, a sort of turf war for authority, right? And what's so profoundly difficult in thinking about that is not only that it spans several centuries, but that, you know, we receive all of this as sort of text, right, as written down text, whether it's Homer, right, whether it's Socrates through Plato or whatever. And yet here you have a transition from mass entertainment composed orally, extemporaneously by the poets through to Xenophanes, who was also composing orally, mm-hmm, and not composing in writing. And that links him to the poetic oral tradition. But then, you know, moving on into prose and the written word, and also a shift from mass entertainment, among other things, which poetry functioned as well as having a ritual and culturally, mm-hmm, binding function, to something that was done by the few, for the few, probably, you know, in the academies. And, you know, it's easy to forget that philosophy was not accepted as, you know, taken for granted as this, you know, wonderful thing. You know, philosophers were strange and outsiders sort of by definition. Right. And so they had, in that sense, also an antagonistic relationship to the masses. And yet, philosophy is competing with poetry and with sophistry for a kind of authority, right, as a purveyor of the truth, as speaking wisdom, mm-hmm, that they are then borrowing and fighting with the poets for.
So one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is this transition that happens between, you know, this transition you just mapped out from, mm-hmm, more oral tradition to a written tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And I particularly am thinking about this because I think we're you know, living through a revolution in literacy that's comparable,
yeah,
right now with the digital media and all these new ways of communicating. Communication is now so multifaceted and dynamic that it adds a completely, not completely new, but it adds a new dimension in the same way that writing did. And so what was lost, what was gained, we can talk about that. But I wonder how that transition maps on to this optimism, pessimism discussion, and then also the other political, social issues of legitimizing what one's doing.
Right.
No.
It's a complex question.
Yeah.
Two things. I would like to talk a little bit about this because it's of current interest of mine, actually,
right,
with orality and literacy as well in the Greek world. But first, the question of authority and optimism also, what interests me is, I agree completely with Karen that Socrates is a pessimist. There is to me no question about that.
We are very alone.
But the only question that I had in with respect to that was not so much whether he's democratic also in any kind of a practical way, mm-hmm, of efficiently or effectively getting the masses to understand what he's doing. I agree with you. That's also how it ends up symptomatically, if anything, becoming a pessimistic project.
Right.
But I think, and I have only the Phaedrus for that to quote at this, mm-hmm, point, is that he is interested as a teacher, at least in a limited way, to get students to think for themselves. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it optimistically succeeds, the project.
Mm.
But I keep thinking that his whole, the aporia of whether teaching is a techne at all, of whether, mm-hmm, you can teach virtue, and how you can do it without becoming an authority figure, and therefore an authoritarian in teaching others,
right,
how not to be that.
Mm.
That's a problem.
But why only the Phaedrus? I mean, okay, so maybe it's because I'm working on a book on this that is feeling like that model, that's everywhere.
Everyone, but it is because it is so obvious there in that
in
he's
the
trying
Phaedrus
to displace.
Right.
He's trying so cunningly and coyly,
right. Right.
And yet lovingly to displace,
right,
Lysias, to tell him, look, he's not a good model for you. So
right.
Obviously there
right.
you can say,
right.
But he's becoming an authority figure. He's telling people, don't buy into authoritarian models, but the very thing...
Well, but then that makes the point of his unwillingness to leave after his first speech in the Phaedrus is so significant that he's, you know, the daimon says to him, you're not
you
going
to
it says no, stay, and do the palinode, which is what, in a certain sense, on the one hand, undermines that other
yes.
kind of authoritarian, but establishes a whole other kind of authority. But But I mean, I think that's there's an interesting point to be made here with regard to some of the things I've been thinking about with about how Socrates practices politics, because it is always directed to someone, and only in the Apology does Socrates actually address the masses. And he does so in a very conscientious way and a problematic way that would involve a close reading of the Apology. But in general, his politics is individually pursued on an individual basis. And that's what I find really very compelling about what he is doing, is because it's always tuned into the soul of the one with whom he's speaking.
Yeah.
And so he'll say different things in different contexts. Now,
yeah.
It is true that people grant him authority, and as much as he might want to displace that, which he does, I think, actively in certain ways, he also
always.
He always takes it
earnestly.
On.
Yes,
right, exactly. But I still don't see. I mean, I'm just not convinced yet that pessimism and optimism are the ways, the best ways to get at this. But part of me is like, well, a feeling that. Yeah, Socrates was optimistic and he was pessimistic. Everybody has that, right?
Sure.
It's not like
you're
a one or the other. Why
right.
do we have to choose? What is it about telling that story in that way that we get an enriched understanding of this dynamic context?
Yeah, I mean, that's hard. I mean, it's funny. We said, you know, maybe Socrates didn't belong, but he's the one who's so much easier to talk to, you know,
yeah.
because I think, you know, Lesher's thinking about the Milesians and the Ionians and the Fusikoi,
right,
who are interested in the underlying structure of the natural world,
right,
and replacing a narration of the past deeds of gods and heroes with an account of what underlies what is now. Right. And then Socrates just really complicates this
mm-hmm.
because he turns away from this, as we know, in the Phaedo, so in his own intellectual biography. So he says, or so Plato has him say. So probably we really have to be careful then about maybe thinking about it, you know, three different, thinking about poetry, thinking about the proto-philosophers,
right.
and thinking about the odd thing that this sort of ethical,
Socrates.
Political turn that Socrates
right.
wants to do that then rejects what his predecessors were doing, which is also a kind of claim of authority
right.
over...
Right. And
that.
It gets even more complicated because if you had Plato in there as the writer...
I meant to, this would have been the second part. I'm sure you both know, but in case, because it tends to be more from a classicist perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you know the work of Eric Havelock at all?
Yes,
yeah.
of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
He's wonderful.
Yes, because I was thinking of that.
But, right, but I mean, the thing about Havelock, and I mean, I really am skeptical in a certain way of
this
story that gets told about this, you know, pre-rational, irrational, you know, poetic
right.
way of speaking and,
right.
and acting and you know, thinking.
Right.
And that's emerging more and more rational. I mean,
yes.
you know,
Me
that's
too.
That's something that we have to problem with.
It's also
right?
the issue of, I think, of democratization or even the definition of philosophy for him that he says it's it really starts proper with writing.
Yes.
That it's really with Plato that
mm-hmm.
that we can speak about philosophy as a kind of a discipline or coming
mm-hmm.
onto its own. So for him the proto-philosophers also in that sense he
mm-hmm.
he groups Socrates at least for that with them.
With the oral because he didn't write?
Because he didn't as a non-writing philosopher he considers them I think still as doing those kind of
right.
wisdom
right.
practicing of wisdom this
right.
or what
mm-hmm.
Bernan calls the sages
right.
rather than
right.
the philosopher.
Okay.
Right.
And therefore becoming more democratized not necessarily in the effect that philosophy indeed can turn the masses into becoming better people necessarily,
mm-hmm.
but that the technology of writing
mm-hmm.
makes available that very dialogue.
Right.
So what is it about writing what is it about the technology of writing that makes it available more broadly? Are you saying that, right, because there's a way in which the oral tradition was broadly available. Now, there was, I mean, perhaps there is a sense of having some distance from the text because when you recite something, you're just reciting it and sort of flowing through you in this kind of along the model of a muse, you know. But
well, it depends
writing,
on if you're the poet or if you're just
the
rhapsode,
right? But in any case, I mean, I'm thinking about the way large populations had access to those texts was through the rhapsodes, and then of course they memorized them themselves. Yes. So, but I'm really interested in what is the what are the affordances and limitations of the technology of writing? I mean, Socrates talks about this in the Phaedrus, where memory is going to be lost. But what have we gained from writing? Well, we're reading these texts, right? Socrates is living on in a way he never would have had Plato not written about
it. Well, and I think also the idea is maybe a certain kind of abstraction, right? Mm-hmm. The ability to think abstractly in a way that
writing brings this.
I mean, if I'm reading my Havelock correctly. I mean, but, you know, I think a lot of sort of classic scholars are thinking about this. Harvey Yunus, I think, is wonderful. Nadoff is great. But I think a lot of people have been talking about this recently in the scholarship. And I don't know that I'm qualified to say.
I don't either. It occurs to me, and I don't remember now Havelock's text that well, but I always am intrigued by the rise of writing in relation to the rise of legislation in Greece at the time. And because the Phaedrus is so much related, I think, to the question of law also.
Yeah.
The question of law versus the question of love, of the commandment that's written versus the...
So there's a certain kind of publicity that comes with writing that is maybe more stable. Because rules, laws can be written down, posted for everyone to
which
see.
Which they were.
Right, exactly.
Which they were. And they allow for an equal treatment also for the citizen. You can't, memory then cannot be used in its negative sense of saying, oh, I don't remember, and that's why this case can be treated unfairly vis-a-vis the other. But if there is the writing available, then
so it's the very stability of writing, the very static nature, which worried Socrates so much, and or at least in the story that he's telling, it worries, you know, Tois and Thalamus talk about this. But the issue is in part though, it makes Plato's decision to write and to write the way he wrote in dialogue so interesting and so rich, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess I read that part of the Phaedrus as not actually being about writing versus speaking, right? But a certain kind of writing versus I think even things that are written. So I'm trying. I think even because, of course, the thing is that the people who learn from the Sophists are also they might be speaking orally, but they're speaking without knowing, and they're simply repeating without knowing, which was the complaint about writing, that writing repeats without knowing. But in fact, that's what you do when you just memorize what Gorgias says. The justice is, and then you repeat it without knowing. Right. So it's not really about writing per se. And I think Plato's own, you know, the way you get out of the sort of the thing that you hope that every group of students notices at some point, that Plato seems to be then contradicting himself if he's writing about how bad writing is, right? Is that you see that Plato's own writing is a kind of example of the very thing that speech is could maybe be good for, though Plato sadly is not there for us to answer our questions, but he was never there.
Yeah. And I don't think, I think that shows itself in the text, so you don't really need to, I mean, he's saying it insofar as that shows forth in the text that he wrote, so we don't need to go, I don't think at least we need to go try and find him, knock on his door and get a, you know, hey, Plato,
it wouldn't help us anyway.
Right, exactly.
Which is actually what I've been writing about in aesthetics, but that's another story.
Well, I want to thank you, Karen, and you, Calliope, for joining me on the Digital Dialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.